Thank you very much, sir. It's a pleasure to be in with you tonight. Well, before I leave this, and I will leave it right after this story, Forrest sent a little something to me. That's what I love about the Coast to Coast AM audience. You really are the coolest, most well-informed audience on this or any other planet. Here we go. And then I'll leave it. Casper, Wyoming. That's not exactly the largest metropolis in our country, is it? This is from November 30. A man wielding a sharp-edged weapon, hence the Neanderthal man music. I'm not sure they had edged weapons, but you get the drift. Well, this person killed one in a Casper neighborhood Friday before killing a male teacher and himself in front of students in a community college classroom, causing a campus-wide lockdown as authorities tried to piece together what happened. So you see, in this case, firearms had absolutely nothing to do with it. So would everybody please just get off of it? Because believe me, it's a lot easier to have your civilization overthrown if you're unarmed. And as the old bumper sticker says, politicians prefer unarmed peasants. Can't wait. Absolutely cannot wait and will not wait to get into our discussion tonight. What a lot of work. The Giza Death Star destroyed. Secrets of the Unified Field. This is the second book in the list I'm reading. Philadelphia Experiment. The Nazi Bell and the Discarded Theory. Nazi International. The Nazis' Post-War Plan to Control Finance, Conflict, Physics, and Space. Roswell and the Reich. The Nazi Connection. Babylon's Banksters. The Alchemy of High Finance, Deep Physics, and Ancient Religion. Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. The Surviving Elites of the Cosmic War and Their Hidden Agenda. And tonight, Transhumanism. A grimoire of alchemical agendas. We'll be back with Drs. Joseph P. Farrell and Scott D. DeHart in just a moment. This is the one, the only Coast to Coast AM. Without further ado, because there's been too much already, let us bring into the global living room along with you, Drs. Joseph P. Farrell and Scott D. DeHart. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having us on.
You were last on with George Norrie back in April of 2011. That's a little bit too long. And what an amazing body of work you have here. It's just stunning what you've put out.
Well, thank you. It's been a long haul, and they're all kind of related to each other, so think of them as one big book.
Yeah, I was sort of getting the drift as I went through it. I don't know. There's so much we can get into, but tonight we'll talk about transhumanism. Mm-hmm. Tell us what that is. I've looked around the web just to try and find some sort of a coherent definition of it, but it still has the yawn factor if I do it, so you do it.
Well, it's an interesting question, John, and I'll give my take and then kind of let Scott give his. As far as I'm concerned, and when we were starting the research on this, we ran into an interesting thing, and that's why we structured the book the way we did. And that is, transhumanism to us is the total transformation of mankind. In other words, what we're trying to do in the book is raise the question, what is it to be human, and what do we want to become? Transhumanism views humanity as something that's pliable, that's malleable, that they can engineer and remake in any fashion that they wish. And they do so by a variety of technological means that we get into in the book. So one of the definitions that we ran into is actually a definition that's given by Ray Kurzweil. And in his book, The Singularity Is Near, he says that transhumanism really is the extension of human consciousness, of humanity, throughout the universe. And when he said that, that kind of got, at least for my part, got me thinking that, well, what they're really talking about then is alchemy. Because one of the things that alchemy talks about repeatedly in its lore is that in order to confect the philosopher's stone, you know, the transmutation of base metals into gold,
yes,
it's first necessary for mankind to transmute himself. So they look to a transformation of mankind, the elevation of his consciousness, the gaining of immortality. And all of this in alchemy is through technological means. So that's kind of what led us to the idea that transhumanism, viewed in that light, is really talking about nothing more than alchemy in modern scientific and technological clothes.
And now alchemy, to the layman, is just taking one thing, like lead, and then converting it to a much more valuable substance, which would be gold. At least that's
right.
The
right.
commonly encountered story.
Right, and that's a profound clue into what the transhumanists think they're doing. They think literally that these technologies that, you know, we're going to be talking about tonight in conjunction with this alchemical agenda, they truly think that what they're doing is transforming base humanity into something new, something different, something improved, you know, humanity upgrade version 2. And they're doing this by a variety of means, you know, that all, when you start to look at the comparison between transhumanism and alchemy, each of the four stages of alchemy and the descent of man in esoteric lore and in alchemy is in evidence in transhumanism. So they're basically trying to reverse engineer the whole alchemical process.
Well, you know, looking at grimoire, you know, at first you think, what does this mean, a grim story? It's actually a textbook of sorcery and magic, yes?
Yes, yes.
A magician's
exactly.
manual for invoking demons and the spirits of the dead.
Yes, exactly. And that's exactly what we try to convey with the use of that word. What transhumanism is, they have what they call the GRIN technologies, genetic, robotic, informational processing, and nanotechnology. And these are the four main technologies that they are looking at, the transhumanists are looking at, to transform mankind by a technological means. Well, when you get right down to it, then, what they're talking about is a recipe book. They've got a grimoire, basically, of what we call alchemical agendas. And that, basically, is where we're coming from in this book.
And to borrow also to jump in there, Joseph, the quotation of Arthur Clarke, any sufficiently advanced technological advance is
right.
indistinguishable from magic.
Right.
It is one.
Well, that's true.
We chose that intentionally.
Well, yes, and the magician knows how the trick is done, so we sit in amazement in the audience, and the magician just goes through the motions.
Right, right. One of the things that we need to start out with, John, is the idea in alchemy that you have four stages of mankind, of the origin of mankind. And when you first hear these things, they sound so totally removed from anything modern. They begin with mankind in his highest state, which is an androgyny, in other words, a fusion of male and female. And then as mankind differentiates more and more, he falls, so to speak, into a mineral condition. And then he falls further into a vegetable condition. And then finally, in the final stage of mankind, the fourth stage of mankind, you have animal man. So if you look at it in terms of modern cosmology, this is exactly the sequence of things that you see in modern cosmology. You begin in this state of nothingness, basically, and then you descend from there, the creation of the elements after the Big Bang, and then you've got the appearance of plant life, and then finally animal life. Well, what alchemy tries to do is to back engineer or reverse engineer that process so that mankind can ascend back up that ladder. And that's exactly what the transhumanists are doing, because when you look at what they're talking about all sorts of fusions of mankind and mineral, mankind and plants, mankind and animals. So in other words, you're dealing, once again, basically with an old, old esoteric agenda.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, all right. It is. It truly is.
Well, let me just add, let's just jump right into it, and then let's get into the what's generally called the fall of man.
Right.
Are the people who are perpetrating this transhumanistic initiative, are they in any way in touch with these ancient spirits? Do they exist? Are spirits and the unseen world of the spirits, is this a component of your, what is clearly, scientific research?
Oh, boy. I think we'd have to answer yes. One of the things that we mentioned in the book toward the very end is the ascent back up to androgyny. And one of the things that if you examine the ancient texts very clearly, they speak of this state of mankind. Even the Bible, if you look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, in the original Greek, if you read the Greek carefully enough, you'll discover that, again, it's referring to a primordial state of androgyny. Well, what the transhumanists appear to be doing is they are reverse engineering this whole process to get back to some primordial state. And when we were researching the book, Scott and I were just dumbfounded. We discovered that Oak Ridge National Laboratory is researching genetic makeup of homosexuality in conjunction with other behavioral genetic research that they're doing. So it's almost as if they are looking for something that would give them the clue or the insight into the primordial aspect of the human genome. So I would have to answer yes. You know, I can't speak for my co-author on that, but that would be my answer.
Well, I would add in there that we find that there have been continual and even recent scientific experiments being conducted even in the United States where androgens, mixed sex human embryos, have been created under the guise of harvesting stem cells. However, the fact that the experiments are aiming at a particular form of a human or something that is human-like reaches not only into the question as to what is it specifically about that type of being, but you tie it back into the alchemistic agenda in the Middle Ages and tie it back further into the ancient ideas that are taught in cultures and in various religions, and it begins to seem like a seamless, threaded fabric that every culture, philosophy, religion, and those who would seek to control it are keen on recovering. And that was a very important issue for us.
This is very interesting. Now, I'm just a little confused, and in this way. Does transhumanism involve the spiritual and alteration of our physical and otherwise natural selves?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Because so this thing about the British and their 150-some-odd different varieties of cross-pollinated creatures, shall we call them, this is part and parcel to it.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Well, if the ultimate goal is to reach a higher level of consciousness as an entire society, that has a very ancient idea in a much earlier civilization before a supposed linguistic fall of mankind, a supposed sexual fall of mankind, a supposed cultural philosophical fall of mankind. There is a unity in the earliest views of civilization. So to recover that, man has to be seen as part of the macrocosm. And in a sense, the macrocosm has to be part of himself. That is a very spiritual cosmic awareness that is in every way related to fusing the biological and the technological into an individual or creating an individual that could be, in a sense, the medium connecting the linguistic as well as the sexual as well as the cultural philosophy that unites mankind. It is a very, not just in terms of a physical expression in transhumanism, it is a consciousness. And if you call that spiritual, it is very spiritual.
Yeah, let me add one thing to what Scott said, if I may, John.
Absolutely.
In the beginning of the book, we go through a bunch of ancient texts and view them from the standpoint of what we call the Tower of Babel moment, when mankind loses that primordial unity. So in other words, there's always a spiritual component to this. And one of the most interesting texts, we thought, was the ancient Mayan Popol Vuh. Because in that text, you have a clear statement that mankind was in this primordial state of unity. And because of that, mankind possessed unique, almost godlike knowledge. And as such, therefore, constituted a threat to the gods. And so they came down and split up mankind and divided mankind. And you find that idea again even in the Old Testament with the Tower of Babel story there. Because, again, what do you have? You have a claim being made that if mankind completes this tower, and, of course, the idea of a tower is connotes or conjures up the image of ascent back up to something. Well, if mankind completes the tower in the Old Testament version of the story, the statement is made that he will be able to do whatsoever he imagines to do. So in other words, again, it's this idea of a lost knowledge and power, and therefore mankind has to be divided. So there's a definite spiritual component to this when the transhumanists are talking about engineering all of these chimerical creations, because again, what they're trying to do is climb that ladder of descent of mankind when he fell. They're trying to reverse that whole process and climb back up.
Do you find as you go through these texts that some of the, well, with the advent of some of the ones who came after the ancient texts, like this Ludwig Andreas von Feuerbach, is there a little bit of a contradiction here between the spiritual and the fact that so many of these people were professed atheists? How is it possible to have one without the other?
Oh boy. That goes, we think, to the heart of what we call an ancient topological metaphor of the physical medium. And what we mean by that is if you look at a lot of these different ancient texts, they're basically giving you more or less the same cosmology. Everything begins from a state of absolute nothingness, and this is a real difficult thing for the modern mind to wrap itself around. But if you go back and you read early Christian mystics, or if you read early philosophers, the Neoplatonists and so on, or even for that matter, the Vedic literature from India, they'll all come down and say that God is nothing. In other words, that there's no known predicate in the human mind or experience that can be univocally applied to God. And therefore, that God is quite literally nothing. All right? So, you know, that kind of gives rise to the old joke, you know, what's the difference between an atheist and a mystic? Well, the only difference is a mystic capitalizes the word nothing. So this metaphor...
That's a good one.
Yeah, this metaphor can be taken and has been interpreted in both a theistic and an atheistic sense, and done so legitimately in both cases. So if there is a presence, as there is in so many transhumanists, of an atheistic impulse, really it's because they're looking at this metaphor, we think, in terms of just one of its paradigms. But there's that other paradigm of a theistic interpretation. But the end result, and this is what really kind of grabbed us when we started doing the research, John, the end result of this is the same. Because in either case, what they're really talking about is, once again, this total transformation of mankind, especially human society and culture and consciousness.
I think I would jump in also to add that even among those who might be considered some of the foremost medieval theologians, mm-hmm. they were also, in some cases, men of science. And some of what they were attempting to do would border on the line of what I think today many people would say was heresy, mm. and yet they were also the advocates and the writers of some of the most important theology at the time, and they are still read today as great theologians of the church, which raises the question, where is that line between science and faith, and what is permissible and what is not permissible? And there were quite a few of them that pushed the boundaries of that line right up to the very edge of what I would say, was lingering on recreating some form of early mankind without the means of either women or God.
Right.
Well, we're going to come up on a hard break here, so if we don't get to finish, if I have to jump in there and chop us off, I definitely want to find out, well, I don't know. My brain's going in about six different directions right here at the moment, so I'm going to. Yeah, it really is. I wonder how it is possible that these great thinkers came to some sort of an understanding of the nature of consciousness, according to Neville Goddard, there can be no reality without consciousness. So how did they account for that? Let's take our break and get into it when we come back with our guest tonight. Doctors Joseph P. Farrell and Dr. Scott D. DeHart. Yes, the doctors are in. And this is Coast to Coast AM. You know, let us remember, well, we're well into the ninth now, but this is still the night of the eighth. Isn't it just amazing? When was John Lennon murdered? December 8th, 32 years ago. I remember I worked for a rock station called The Zoo, KZEW, and I was so stunned when the news came over the national airwaves that John Lennon had been shot dead in New York City. I had never done this before. I was sitting next door to a friend's house, and I just felt compelled to grab the, I don't know, it's no wonder you mix it with Coca-Cola most of the time, it's a kiddie drink, but I took a swig of Jack Daniels, and it did not help. The next morning, I wrote in soap across the back of this black Trans Am I had in those days, Lennon was murdered, miss him. And when I got to the station, I was shocked to see. I also ripped off a piece of a black t-shirt and I tied it around my arm. I didn't know what else to do. He'd just been so much a part. He and the Beatles had been so much a part of my youth. And they never sang about anything except love and brotherhood and things like this. So I'm not convinced that the instant karma he was talking about, I'm not sure that karma had anything to do with it at all, except a case can be made for it. Can it? Because for someone who sang and preached about really nothing but love, to meet an end like that seemed ever so incongruous. You know, it's common knowledge that there are consequences for one's actions, sometimes punishment. And sometimes punishment comes even for those who did nothing. So are there people out there actually trying to make the argument that since punishment is levied upon the innocent, that every guilty person should not be punished? To put balance into the system. To balance the karma. Especially if it's good for business. We really should remember what, in my opinion, was the real greatest rock and roll band in the world. And I'm not even sure that it was rock and roll. It was something entirely different. But I hope you'll indulge me just a few moments to recognize the passing of John Lennon. A tragedy for all of us, whether we liked his music or not. We'll be back with our guests in just a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. John B. Wells in with you for the ride tonight with our guest tonight, Drs. Joseph P. Farrell and Scott D. DeHart. Say, just to wrap it up on that John Lennon thing, when I got to the station, everybody looked at me like I was crazy. It's like, well, what? What are you making such a big deal out of it? And of course, a couple of days later came the unprecedented 1 minute of silence. Weenies. Anyway, back to our guest tonight. Gentlemen, please carry on with where we were, which is, how do you define reality? These people who are trying to affect this transhumanistic initiative, they must have given some consideration to the actual nature of human reality, our perception of a world and a universe. So how is this, can you shed any light on what is their definition of reality? Is it a malleable reality, or is it a fixed reality yet can be manipulated by them through these physical / spiritual means?
That's a hell of a great question. I think, John, for my 2 cents worth, and then I'll let Scott jump in, but for my 2 cents worth, John, I think you put your finger right on it. For them, humanity is a malleable thing. It's something that they can mold and shape and twist and stretch into any shape that they want. And again, they're not really concerned, ultimately, with what it means to be human in the sense that you and I would use it. What they're aiming at is, as we said in the first segment, they're aiming at this total transformation of human consciousness, and they can remake that into anything that they want it to be as well. So, yeah, definitely they view it as something malleable.
I would agree entirely with Joseph's comments on that. The idea of fusing man with whatever could be imagined is part of the agenda. It really doesn't matter so long as the experiment moves forward and the end product, whether it is partial man, partial animal, partial technological or biological, is of really no consequence. The end result is just what happens to come out of it.
Let me give you an example, John, of what we were talking about in that respect. When we were researching this book, we found an instance, you know, there are some transhumanists that actually will use the word manimal, in other words, to refer to these fusions of mankind and animal. And we found an example. We were just both kind of dumbfounded when we encountered this. But there were some genetic engineers, I forget exactly where right off the top of my head, that had engineered a mouse to produce human cells, human sperm cells. So in other words, it raises the prospect that eventually they would be able to create a human being whose parents quite literally aren't human at all. They're mice. And that raises the question in law, then, what does it mean to be human? And, you know, transhumanism is barreling down the tracks at us like a locomotive, and it's raising all of these philosophical questions and legal questions, and unfortunately, I think most people are unaware that these things are coming down the pike, and already, you know, just since the book has been out, one of the things that Scott and I speculated on, John, was that by eating all of these genetically modified foods, there could be a possibility that would introduce genetic modifications in the people consuming it. Well, you know, we've already found an article since then. I plan to blog about it on my website that indicates that this is indeed happening. And already we're finding, you know, some of these companies that are doing these genetic experiments. Now the Supreme Court's going to hear a case on whether or not that type of being can be patented. So in other words, this is racing down the tracks at us in any number of directions, not just technologically, but culturally and in terms of our law.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's drink from this cup for a moment. Now, you'd have to embrace the existence, the belief in the existence of UFOs and ETs and so forth. Is there anything in your research that suggests that ETs are a component in this? Are they assisting the humans?
Oh boy. In my own body of research, I wrote a book called Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men that you referred to at the beginning of the show.
Yes.
And if you look at some of those ancient texts that we discuss kind of in a roundabout way in the transhumanism book, but in that other book more particularly, you do find the idea that mankind was somehow engineered into existence, that we are ourselves already chimerical creatures of a sort. Now, the interesting thing, the interesting biological problem that raises is that in order for that to occur, there has to be some sort of genetic resemblance to begin with. And, you know, the transhumanists are really saying with all of these fusions that Scott talked about, what they're really saying is that the line or the definition of human nature is very, very fuzzy and can bleed over into species that we wouldn't even recognize as human.
This is pretty scary stuff. The Nazis were into this, were they not?
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely. You know, the Nazis were trying to create, you know, with their Lebensborn genetic programs and so on, they were trying to create a new kind of man. The Soviets were trying to create a new Soviet man and engineer quite literally out of existence in humanity this idea of consciousness or spirituality. So you have all of these things at work in it.
Not to exclude what is taking place within our own country.
Oh, yeah.
With the mice experiments.
Yeah, exactly.
With the sheep and the pigs with human blood. This is a worldwide phenomenon now.
Yeah.
There are a lot of phenomena that seem to be occurring all at once, as if I don't know if there's anything, this 2012 thing. I'm suspicious of all these sorts of declarations, but it doesn't escape my notice that according to statistics, and as we know, Mark Twain said, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics, but it appears that suicide is now at the top of the list as far as injury-induced causes of death.
Well, it's interesting, John, that you mention the 2012 thing, because one thing that we encountered in this whole transhumanist research that we were doing is the almost apocalyptic outlook that you have among some transhumanists. They all are future-oriented. They're all saying, in other words, that all of these technological gimmicks that we're now able to perform are bringing a new world into existence, and it's really the end game, so to speak. It's the final transformation of humanity for many of these people, and for many of them, they even talk about circumventing or going around or short-circuiting the process of evolution and taking the whole thing into our own hands. Well, once you've said that, then we get into three different scenarios in the book. The heaven scenario, that all of this is going to bring about some sort of glorious utopia, a golden age. And then you have the hell scenario, that this is going to so completely obliterate humanity as we know it that, you know, it will be quite literally a living hell for humans of the normal variety. And then there is a kind of a middle-of-the-ground scenario that some people call the prevail scenario, that we're going to somehow muddle through this and reject some aspects of this. But any way you slice it, John, you're absolutely right. You're dealing with an apocalyptic viewpoint.
And one which has been repeated throughout, it seems, the story or the myth of human history. Civilizations that were very advanced and disappeared. Civilization that rose again and disappeared. And with every advance seems to be an over-advance, which leads to either an intervention from a higher being that pushes humanity back down, divides it, splits it. This going back as far as Plato, even, or like some of the earliest religious texts, whether one takes the Hindu text or takes the biblical text. The recurring theme of a civilization which has reached beyond what it should somehow strikes the anger or the threat of the divine being, which strikes it, splits it, divides it, conquers it, and puts it back into a place where either everything must begin again from anew or be rebuilt from a very low level, recover the technologies of the past, recover the knowledge of the past, kind of a Ayn Rand anthem moment of reawakening to learning and re-achieving what man is capable of, and every time it seems to go around and around.
I'm just wondering, what is mankind supposed to be capable of in the wildest extrapolation of these transhumanists' dreams?
Oh, boy. Again, I think it goes back to something that Ray Kurzweil mentioned in his book, John, and that is they're aiming to transform the universe in the image of man. That quite literally is what he's talking about when he says that these technologies are now making the idea of extending human consciousness and putting the human stamp on the entire universe. That's literally what they mean. So in other words, in a certain sense, they're violating that old dividing line between man and God. They literally are viewing themselves with godlike powers.
And therefore, it would follow that they would perhaps attempt to expand human consciousness beyond this mortal coil of a body.
Right, exactly. They talk. Yeah. Yeah, they talk about computer chips and downloading a person's entire memory. They talk about nanotechnology that would be capable of repairing the body as it goes. And I'll tell you, John, the most interesting thing, at least for me, in researching all of this, we go back to alchemy. Alchemy taught that the philosopher's stone, in some of its incarnations or manifestations, was a literal elixir of life. It was kind of a universal vaccine. Well, lo and behold, when you read the transhumanism book, we refer to the fact that the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, is in fact investigating all sorts of pathogens in order to determine if they share anything in common, and if so, if that thing in common can be inoculated against. In other words, what they are searching for is quite literally the philosopher's stone. They're searching for that universal vaccine or elixir of life. So there you have it.
This is really fascinating stuff. All right, now let's beat up on the GMO thing for a minute. You know, you hear these people trying to talk about it. Bloomberg says, okay, we're not going to. They're getting $14.50 a pack for cigarettes in New York City. $14.50. I saw it myself, and in fact, I saw somebody buy some last week. He wanted to put a ban on 16-ounce drinks. Of course, it's okay, I guess, if you carry 2 8-ounce drinks, but whatever. We're being told by the White House, First Lady, that we must change our diets. Well, if this is in furtherance of improving human health, why do we not ban high fructose corn syrup, ban partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, ban margarine, ban aspartame, ban acetaminophen while you're at it? That's not really food. And why have these people gotten into this genetically modified organism? We were doing fine with natural seeds, but now they've produced this this strain of seeds that really cause problems. They thin the gut on the animals when they're fed the GMOs and causing all sorts of health problems. And then I just heard that Bill Gates has invested in Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is this?
Well, there's two tracks to this, I think, John. And the first is, the bottom line in the first instance, is profits. The simple thing is that in patent law, in American patent law, a seed that is produced through normal agronomical practice that mankind has been pursuing for thousands of years is very different from genetically modified organisms or crops, because those have direct, sudden interventions of humanity. And therefore, the product of that technology is patentable. So in other words, you're looking at quite literally billions, if not trillions of dollars in profits from the standpoint of changing all of human agriculture to GMO foods. These companies stand to make huge, enormous profits. But there is, I suspect, and we wrote about this in the book, there is, I suspect, a much deeper problem, and that is that if you look at alchemy, the philosopher's stone is said to be able to promote longevity and to give life, in other words, to transform mankind if it's ingested. And in fact, if you look at most religions, there is some notion of the food of the gods or sacred food or what have you. I mean, my word, even in Christianity, you have the Eucharist, for example, that is supposed to be a deifying meal, all right? So you are what you eat, in other words. That's why we had that quotation of Ludwig Feuerbach in the book. So we also suspect that there may be a much deeper esoteric goal here. By modifying the food, they are attempting to modify mankind. And I go back to something I mentioned earlier, and that is that when we were writing the book, we kind of speculated that, okay, if you can genetically modify this food, wouldn't that inevitably introduce some sort of evolutionary response or genetic modification in mankind himself? And already now we're finding the studies coming out that are beginning to suggest precisely that. So from our standpoint, it may be very deliberate that they're introducing this for yet another means or mechanism for the transformation of mankind.
Unbelievable.
It's affecting the transformation of mankind.
It is affecting the transformation of mankind.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, this is fascinating stuff. That has been a quick hour, and I'm delighted to report we have two more to go. Our guest tonight, Drs. Joseph Farrell and Scott DeHartz. This is fun in a scary kind of way. Hopefully it won't become too scary. Thank you very much for being with us tonight. We shall continue. This is Coast to Coast AM.